lead bank and agent bank liability. We want to understand how we can control and structure rights and duties in large, complex finance transactions and effectively allocate responsibility for loss and liability. We have to understand these large, complex transactions, and what we're essentially doing is allocating loss. We do that through the documentation that we have, having regard both to the contractual provisions as well as underlying key points, principles and areas of core contract, tort, delict and other forms of liability. I've prepared a short outline which explains and goes through all of this. We're looking at the heads of liability. We'll look at limitation of liability in terms of what we call, or I call, limited duty clauses. These are also called basis clauses. If we clarify the basis and scope of a duty, then there can be no liability outside that duty. So you limit liability by narrowing duty. We can also exclude liability, so we need to consider the provisions that apply with regard to limiting liability under contract law specifically, although there's various other forms that we can control liability, the amount of liability through, for example, exclusion, set-off, estoppel, indemnity and contributory negligence. There are, nevertheless, certain controls and restrictions which apply to limiting liability, so we have to consider that in terms of contractual construction, essentially what we call the contract proferentum rule. If you've drafted an exclusion clause in your favour, if that has to come to a difficult point of interpretation because there's some uncertain point of meaning or clarification, that will be interpreted against your interest because you drafted the clause and it's to limit your liability. So a contract proferentum, that's against the party, against the party's interest, that doctrine will apply in construing any clauses against the party who drafted the exclusion. Exclusion clauses have no application in certain areas, including fraud and fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, where the clause itself has been misrepresented, or where there's separate, contrary, oral, separate undertakings to act which are in conflict with the terms of the exclusion clause. There are also certain statutory provisions we have to consider. These were covered under the Consumer Contracts Regulations 1999, which have now been converted, transformed into the Consumer Rights Act 2015. These essentially only apply with regard to consumers. As we're not concerned with consumers in these contracts, we don't need to consider this further. We do, however, have to consider the reasonableness test imported under the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977. So we'll understand how reasonableness applies in practice. The key point here is simply that we're dealing with large professional counterparties. The lenders, the borrowers, the arranging banks will be financial institutions which will be authorised and have all of the necessary expertise and training. The borrowers will also usually be either government agencies or some of the largest companies in the world, so they will also be considered to be sophisticated or professional or expert forms of investors. So the type of test, the sort of analysis that you would apply becomes completely different from considering, for example, a bank dealing with a consumer. It's a completely separate set of relationships in these large wholesale international finance contracts that we're looking at. With regards to remedies, we simply need to understand the core rights of action that a party not in breach will have against the other. I've summarised them in terms of five key points. We can have suspension or withholding of further advance, cancellation of the obligation to lend, acceleration of repayment. You actually have to ask for repayment, it doesn't apply by implication or automatically. You can rescind the document, and then you can also sue for damages for breach of contract or in tort. We want to understand how all of this applies in practice. The key issue is to identify all of the core possible heads of liability, potential points of liability, and then how we can manage and control these in practice, in particular by allocating loss, as we've already explained. We're looking at liability in terms of potentially the borrower, the lead bank, the manager or the arranger, the other members of a participant, and then other possible financial institutions that were involved, such as the underwriters and the selling group if it was a bond issue. We've also got the agent bank, both in the loan deal and the bond deal. We have to consider all possible relevant heads of liability. This will arise in practice simply because the borrower or the borrower's group will have drawn down funds either in the form of a syndicated loan or through a bond issue, note issue or commercial paper issue, and then the company cannot repay. The question then arises, the lenders or the investors who purchased the bonds and notes of paper, what remedies do they have? This was not considered in a number of the early large transactions that were put together in these areas, in this area. I've summarised a large number of the particular transactions in the historical chapter and then structural chapter, chapters 1 and 2. It was not until 1976, you'll see in the text here, in the famous case called Colcatrona's Tanker Securities Litigation, that this was really considered important. In that case, European American Banking Corporation, EABC, had set up a syndicate with a large number of American regional banks, which was to provide funding to the Colcatrona's shipping group. The banks argued that the lead manager had a duty to advise them on all material facts relevant to the credit, because the bank was an expert in assessing credit, and then had failed to do so in providing material untrue statements of fact and then omitting other core points of detail. In that case, the arranging bank, EABC, actually repaid all of the funds due to the participating banks. So that was quite an extreme example. This caused material shock in banking and finance markets when everybody realized they had to focus on this point of liability. So we then have to consider specifically the possible liability of the lead bank or the arranging bank, and then also the agent bank. In practice, if we're the lawyers drafting the documentation, what we're going to do is clearly and specifically define their duties, as well as then incorporate appropriate exclusion of liability clauses. Specifically, the agent bank is only carrying out limited administrative or executive functions. It will not receive any large substantial payments under the facility or the loan or the bond. Therefore, it doesn't want to have any possible wider heads of liability. So we specifically need to ensure that the position of the agent bank is protected. The lead bank will receive a generous payment in terms of a proportion either of the loan or bond facility which is set up. However, again, in practice, the lead bank will have undertaken all proper care and due diligence, and therefore, again, it's appropriate that we limit its liability accordingly. The other members of a syndicate will generally not have any liability with regards to each other, because they've entered into no separate obligations with regard to each other or made any separate representations with regards to each other. Again, in the bond issue, you've got the selling group, you've got the underwriting group. It's very unlikely that they could be held liable simply because the prospectus will have been prepared by the arranging bank in cooperation with the borrower. The only other parties would then be the trustee, and then, as we've said, the fiscal agent and the paying agent. In both of those cases, we will ensure that there's very limited possible heads of liability. So we need to understand all of the relevant possible causes of claim, and then how we can appropriately manage and control liability. In practice, you'll see that we have a number of key main possible heads of liability. We've got common law misrepresentation, we've got statutory misrepresentation and deceit, we have agency liability, we have fiduciary liability, and then regulatory liability. In terms of common law misrepresentation, somebody can be held, a party can be considered to have committed either fraudulent misrepresentation, negligent misrepresentation, or innocent misrepresentation. This is at the bottom of the page, or possibly fraud. Fraudulent misrepresentation arises where a misrepresentation has been made with knowledge of falsity or reckless, not caring whether it was true or false. In such cases, the most important remedy is rescission. We can rescind the contract, although damages will also be available. And I've given you some of the main case law that applies in this area. For example, Derry versus Peak, 1889, 14 appeal cases, 337 House of Lords. Negligent misrepresentation arises where there's a special relationship of trust or confidence. The leading case was Headley Byrne versus Headley Partners, which concerned a law firm. You have to establish an appropriate relationship as well as inducement and causation. And again, I've given you some of the main case law in this area, J.E.B. Fasteners, the Lucy Eddington versus Fitzmaurice. Statements of law are not misrepresentations to the extent that everyone is assumed to know the law. The statement must generally be one of fact rather than law, advice, opinion, or intention. There are, however, special cases which apply, and this is in the footnotes at the bottom of this page and top of the next page. Statements of opinion can be held to constitute actual misrepresentations where the opinion is not actually held or implies facts that are incorrect. That's Brown versus Raphael and River Silver Mining. Statements of intention can be actionable where they were not held at the time they were made. Eddington versus Fitzmaurice. Forecast can also be create liability where these constitute an implied misrepresentation as to the relevant facts. Summaries also where they are not fair and misleading. We have to consider the possible nature of the misrepresentation and then the possible different aspects of liability that can arise in practice. Innocent misrepresentation can also be available. In that case, there may not be damages simply because it's not considered sufficiently important. There may also not be rescission. However, you'll see at the top of this page where damages would otherwise be, if rescission was otherwise available, what the courts can actually do is they can deny the rescission remedy and only award damages in case so that we can ensure the enforceability of the contracts. So we have to consider misrepresentation under fraudulent, negligent, and innocent misrepresentation. We've also got statutory misrepresentation under the Fraud Act, which is where a company director can be held liable for having issued an inappropriate statement. We'll then get statutory misrepresentation and deceit. Deceit is under the Theft Act, that's section 19, 1968. An officer of a body corporate will be held liable to creditors where there has been intentional deceit. We've also, fifthly, got statutory misrepresentation. That's under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. The difficulty that had arisen in practice was that you had to establish fraud to qualify for rescission in common law cases. Therefore, they established the Misrepresentation Act 1967 to allow for rescission without the need to establish fraud. Effectively, it reverses the burden of proof in misrepresentation actions, and you can proceed if you can establish the misrepresentation. What effectively then happens is that the other party is then subject to the responsibility of satisfying a defence that there was reasonable and proper belief in the accuracy of the fact. So what you effectively do is you reverse the burden of proof by transferring responsibility to the other party to prove that they reasonably believed the matter to be true. In that case, you can avoid liability. Otherwise, you would be held liable under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. We also have to consider possible liability in terms of agency law, and in terms of a fiduciary. A fiduciary is effectively a higher level of standard, again, where there's almost some form of trust or other fiduciary type relationship between the parties. In agency situations, there's three key duties. The agent must carry out contractual duties and comply with instructions. That's Turpin versus Bilton in footnote 17. The agent must exercise reasonable skill and care. That's footnote 18, Henderson versus Merritt. Thirdly, the agent must not delegate its authority. De Busche, ALT, footnote 19. And in addition to those three core duties, the agent must keep appropriate accounts. That's Peirce versus Green in footnote 20. You will apply even higher standards if a fiduciary relationship is created, and this is almost a form of strict liability. So the courts will apply these duties with an even higher level of enforcement and possible severity in practice, and you'll see that in some of the case law. Even where a profit was made for the beneficiary, the court still considered the duties to have been breached and the fiduciary was held liable. So strict application of these standards. The three key duties, and you'll see that under subsection D, the fiduciary must avoid any conflicts of interest. Boston deep sea fishing, the fiduciary must avoid a secret profit. Boardman versus Phipps is the case I was mentioning, and the fiduciary must also exercise due diligence. Knox versus McKinnon. In all of these cases, what we will do in practice is that we will try to ensure that we cannot create an agency or a fiduciary relationship under the documentation that we're going to draft. Therefore, we will specifically clarify and ensure that no agency or fiduciary duty can be created, because otherwise that would give effect to import these implied duties, which could then cause significant problems to our clients in practice. We also have to consider heads of regulatory liability. This principally applies with regards to some of the core banking and financial laws that apply in this area. We have to think about this in terms of authorization, in terms of the loan agreement and the information memorandum. We've also got promotion and then possibly listing, as well as market abuse. The key point to stress is that in large international wholesale markets, much of the activity will be unregulated. If you are borrowing funds on interbank markets and you are lending them to governments or other corporate bodies, that is not regulated banking. The only form of banking that's regulated is deposit taking. Deposit taking involves the receipt of repayable funds from the general public, and then the advancing of loans or credit on own account using those funds. So it's the acceptance of deposits and it's the lending. It has to be both together. In the large international financial transactions that we're looking at, the commercial banks and the investment banks, they obtain the funds in the interbank markets, that's not from the general public, and they will then advance those funds. That does not constitute deposit taking, therefore there's no regulatory activity involved. That's all in the second paragraph there. The third paragraph deals with the issue as to whether the information memorandum in a loan deal could constitute an investment or a security. The relevant provision is creating or acknowledging indebtedness. That's set out in the regulated activities order adopted under the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. The FSMA 2000 lists a number of investments and investment activities in Schedule 2. However, the Act applies to regulated activities defined by order. That's in section 22.1 and 2. By order it's defined, I think it's in section 22.4, which is by order of the Treasury. You have a list of investments and investment activities in Schedule 2. Legally, that has no effect. It's of no effect in law because the definitions have to be by order, which means by direction of the Treasury. The Treasury has issued the Separate Regulated Activities Order, RAO, as amended under the FSME. Though the key definitions are all set out there. While Schedule 2 to the Act is only around 2.25 pages long, the RAO is over 100 pages, because this effectively has to define all financial services, all markets, and everything covered by the Financial Services and Markets Act, the FSME. That will include everything in the banking, securities, insurance, and all other specialist areas, including, for example, credit unions, friendly societies, and every other possible form of non-wholesale activity. There are some types of wholesale business not covered by the FSME, so that they are technically not regulated. We will come back and look at that in a separate class on regulation of wholesale markets. We used to have what we call an NIP, a non-investment products code, the NIP code, that was issued under the Bank of England, that applied to things like wholesale dealing, euro-dollar type business, interbank markets, as well as foreign exchange and gold bullion trading. Much of the activities covered in the course that we are covering. A lot of these wholesale activities would not have fallen within the traditional FSME and therefore required regulation. They were covered separately under the NIP, the NIP code. After the global financial crisis and further events in the markets, it was decided to clarify these further. So we now have three core sets of market codes or market provisions. We have an interbank market code, a UK money market code. We have a separate global foreign exchange code. And then we have a precious metals code, which includes gold and silver, as well as palladium and other precious metals. So we effectively create a non-statutory, self-regulatory, market-based series of codes for the wholesale market area, initially the NIP code, the NIP code, and then the separate money markets, foreign exchange, and precious metal codes. Everything else will be regulated by the FSME. We did not think that the activities in the major wholesale markets would fall within the FSME, principally because they would not constitute any instruments creating or acknowledging indebtedness. This is in footnote 27, as we mentioned already. This is set out in Articles 76 to 82 RAO. There was, however, an interesting case called the Fonds decision, which actually had to consider this issue. And I've given you some of the correspondence on this on the system. So there was actually a letter addressed by the City of London Law Society to Her Majesty's Treasury in the United Kingdom about the implications of the Fonds decision, Fonds HV versus Corporal Limited and Pillar Securitization. The issue that arose was whether two loan agreements could constitute debentures and then fall within the definition of shares and investments under the documentation in this case. It was decided in that particular case that the information memorandum and the loan agreement could constitute an instrument acknowledging indebtedness. This caused very substantial concern in the finance markets and the international finance markets in London, and that's essentially what this letter is about, simply because it had always been assumed that that was not the case and that this was the opposite situation. A loan agreement and an information memorandum to a loan agreement, even the loan agreement itself, does not actually create or acknowledge indebtedness. It only sets out the contractual relationship in terms of which debt can be created. So, in the examples that we've been looking at with regards to a syndicated loan agreement governed by the Loan Market Association, LMA, Standard Multi-Currency Term Loan Provisions, the loan agreement does not constitute debt. It does not create or acknowledge debt. It sets up the relationship and the terms and conditions under which a borrower can draw down under the agreement. It's the drawdown provisions, it's the drawdown submissions It's essentially, I think it's schedules 3 or 4 to the document. That's what creates or acknowledges the indebtedness. It's not the loan agreement itself. So it's arguable that this decision was wrong in law, although we can explain it in terms of the particular facts of that case. And what actually happened was the Financial Conduct Authority, in response to the letter that was sent, confirmed in a very short statement that we did not think that this reverses or changes the FCA's interpretation of the FSMA, principally because neither the FSMA nor the regulated activities order itself were considered in that decision. So they've basically postponed it, almost avoided any potential issue, to the extent that they simply explain this as only being of relevant and only applying with regards to the terms of the particular facts. It is, however, an important issue that we'll have to monitor going forward. Could a loan agreement be considered to constitute an instrument creating or acknowledging indebtedness? In practice, we will not think that the loan agreement does, even subject to the terms of the fund's decision. The information memorandum, again, only sets out terms and describes the factual background to the situation, so it should not be considered to constitute an investment or an investment activity of any form. Additional separate issues may arise with regards to a prospectus in relation to a bond. That will then be subject to the listing provisions. So we have the listing rules, the prospectus rules, and the disclosure and transparency rules set out in the FCA, set out on the FCA website and in the relevant provisions. What had happened was the London Stock Exchange was the UK listing authority, although when the London Stock Exchange decided to demutualise, move from being a member-owned organisation to a public limited a public liability company, and then register, list its own shares on its own market, when that happened, the old FSA, Financial Services Authority, and then the FCA were appointed the listing authority in the UK. The prospectus, to the extent that it's to be made available to the general public, and it will advertise, promote the sale of securities in the form of bonds, that will be regulated under Part 6 of the FSMA and the relevant listing rules, prospectus rules, and disclosure and transparency rules. The other core provisions on regulation are dealt with there. The only separate provision that we have to consider is possible market abuse or market manipulation. There are separate rules which allow manipulation of markets as part of our bond issuing procedure in relation to what we call the grey market. Between the announcement of the launch of the bonds and the actual closing and the delivery of the instruments, which then makes them available for purchase and sale, we will create a grey market. We effectively create a market in the bonds before they're even launched. We can manage the price of the bonds in that under what's called the stabilisation rules, which are an exemption from what would otherwise apply in terms of market abuse. Market abuse was originally dealt with under Section 118 of the Financial Services and Markets Act. The objective of this was to create a form of civil offence for market manipulation. The problem that had arisen was we do have offences under, for example, the Criminal Justice Act 1986 for insider trading, for insider dealing. However, they are subject to a much higher standard of proof because they're criminal offences. We wanted to create a lower burden of proof of reasonable probability for new offences in relation to market abuse under the FSME. That's why we created this sort of quasi-civil offence of market abuse, which was not subject to the higher criminal standards that had to be proved to establish insider trading or market manipulation, insider trading or market abuse. In that case, we will then list various forms of offence under the market abuse section 118. However, that has since been transferred into European law. We now have a separate, what we call a market abuse regulation, that's 596/2014, which reincorporates the offences that were otherwise covered by the market abuse provisions in section 118. Because this is now covered by the European regulation, and a European regulation is directly applicable because it's not simply a directive, it's a regulation, we therefore have disapplied section 118. So section 118 is now dealt with under the separate offences in the market abuse regulation. These will include misuse of information, misleading impressions, other forms of market manipulation devices. There was a separate offence of market manipulation under section 397, which is also referred to in the text at the top here. That's now been replaced by sections 89 and 90 of the Financial Services Act 2012, and that's referred to on your front cover, on the front of this. So, market abuse, this is point 1ED, the market abuse provision in section 118 has now been replaced by the market abuse regulation 596/2014, and the earlier market manipulation provision in section 397 FSMA has now been replaced by sections 89 and 90 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2012. We also then have to consider the different ways that we can limit or control liability in practice. So we have the separate possible heads of liability with common law misrepresentation, either fraudulent statute as fraudulent, innocent or negligent, as well as statutory misrepresentation and deceit. We also have to think about agency duties, fiduciary duties, and then possible regulatory liability. In practice, how do we manage these? We can include a number of what I call limited liability clauses, or these are also referred to as basis clauses in contractual documentation. What these essentially do is limit the scope of a duty of care and terms of responsibility of one party with regards to another. The easiest way to limit liability is not to have a duty to have acted in a certain way which could have created liability in the first place. So we essentially are going to limit liability through controlling the scope of possible duty which arises in practice. We can do that through a series of particular contractual provisions which we can collectively refer to either as no duty clauses or limited duty clauses and basis clauses. So we can express no duty provisions, which will include, for example, agency responsibilities and fiduciary responsibilities, and then more generally just narrow the scope of possible liability insofar as we can. We can have information supply provisions which specify who's providing the information, so that, for example, the lead bank, the arranging bank or the agent bank cannot be held liable because they did not supply that information. So we can have information supply clauses of various forms. We can have independent credit assessment provisions whereby all of the parties, such as the banks in a syndicated loan, are contractually obliged to undertake their own credit assessment, so they cannot say that they relied on the assessment conducted by the lead bank or the arranging bank, as arose in the Kolkotronis case in 1976. We can also have expressed no reliance and no inducement provisions, and then again, if we haven't already excluded this separately, because this is even harsher standard of care above agency duty, we can have a separate no fiduciary duty clause, and we will see that in express terms in the Unfair Contract Terms Act and in the provisions in the Loan Market Association Multi-Currency Term Loan Agreement. You'll see that specifically, section 26, 4. We can also then think about how we can manage liability through a separate series of exclusion clauses. or limited liability clauses. The simplest way is to have an express exclusion of liability. This is provided for under English law, so we have important case law such as Hood versus Swiss Atlantique. We have Photo Production, George Mitchell, Chester Hall. These are traditional, very important English case law which recognise the legitimacy and enforceability of these provisions. There are some limitations which we'll come on to look at. We can also deal with possible liability through the control of set-off. Set-off is where we write off mutual reciprocal obligations. Essentially, it's discharging reciprocal monetary obligations. One party owes another party, and the two parties will then reduce the total amount paid by allowing for the separate payments concerned. Set-off and netting are distinct. Set-off is essentially concerned with the legal basis for the liability to make payment. Netting is a procedural device that takes the two initial obligations which would arise under the set-off and then cancels those and replaces them with a single net payment. So set-off and netting. Set-off is the legal basis. Netting is the mechanism that you can use to replace the initial two obligations with a single net payment. We'll come back and look at this in further detail when we consider international financial derivatives contracts and specifically the International Swaps and Derivatives Association 2002 Master Agreement. We will look at the specific heads of set-off and of netting. In practice, for set-off, we can have legal set-off, we have equitable set-off, we have contractual set-off, we have banker set-off, which is essentially combination of accounts. If a account holder has an overdraft in one account but a large credit balance in another account, the bank can legally allocate one set of funds to cover the debt on another account. And then we have insolvency set-off under the Insolvency Act 1986, Section 323. With regards to netting, there's three main types of netting: novation netting, closeout netting, and settlement netting. We'll come back and look at those in further detail with regards to financial derivatives. Novation netting, that's novation, essentially takes two obligations and replaces them with a single new obligation. Closeout netting and settlement netting are provided for expressly under the 2002 Master Agreement, which replaced the earlier 1992 original Master Agreement for financial derivatives. Continuous or settlement netting applies whereby parties agree that they will net payments on a specific day, for example, each month. So, for example, at 10 o'clock on the first Friday of every month, the parties will agree to net all of their outstanding obligations due under a defined series of contracts in, for example, a specific currency, let's say dollars. We can also make it multi-currency netting, so we can net all of the relevant provisions. Continuous or payment netting then applies on a continuous basis. It's something which applies regularly, whereby, for example, once a month or once a week, we're going to net all the amounts due so that one party only pays the other the residual amount after allowing for all mutual obligations. Closeout netting applies where we terminate the relationship between the two parties and then we have to have a final net settlement payment. So continuous is on a regular basis. Closeout is when we terminate the relationship. That becomes slightly more complicated because we then have to net all possible obligations. We calculate what we call the relevant market value for the obligation due by one party to the other and the other to the other. And then you create an estimate amount of the total amount due by one to the other, and then you net those provisions to create a final payment whereby one party only pays the other the small net amount rather than the total gross payment provided for under the contracts. We can also have estoppel, and I'll give you some additional notes on estoppel with some recent case law in this area with regards to the use and application of basis clauses. Estoppel essentially prevents one party from enforcing a right that it would otherwise have had because it's already acted in a way that contradicts its entitlement to that original claim. This can also be called personal bar, so estoppel or personal bar. We've also got indemnity. Even where one party has to pay another party, we can provide that the second party then has to indemnify the first party for the loss that that party incurred by having to pay the second party. So we can still have indemnity provisions even where the exclusion provisions in, for example, A or the set-off and estoppel clauses don't apply in B or C. So we can still include large sets of indemnity clauses, which we will see in all of the documentation that we are looking at. We also have a separate form of adjustment, which is called contributory negligence under the Contributory Negligence Act 1945. This essentially applies whereby if one party is partly responsible for loss, you reduce the liability to that extent. So, for example, if there has been a claimant, one party is considered to be 40% responsible for the loss, the other party 60% possible for the loss, you deduct the 60 from the 40, so the first party only pays the second party 20%. It's a form of allocated loss, which the courts can also apply when they are making payment orders following the decision on the heads of liability that would otherwise arise. We also then have to consider possible limits on liability. So we have our heads of liability, we have our limitation through limited duty clauses, and then we have our limitation provisions, either exclusion, set-off, estoppel, indemnity, or contributory negligence. What we can then also do is we have to be careful that there are no limitations that would otherwise apply on our limitation of liability in principally 3A. So we have to consider to what extent there are any exclusions or limits on our ability to limit liability. There's three key sets of provisions we have to consider. There's the points of contractual construction, which arise with the contra proferentem rule. You'll see that at the beginning of this section here. If a party has drafted a clause which limits its liability, that clause will be interpreted against its interest. So it's contra proferentem. If there's any uncertainty with regards to the scope of liability, that will be construed, interpreted against that party. And I've seen this happen very many times in practice. It's a very simple but a very important, powerful doctrine. You can also not exclude liability for certain heads of liability. So fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, you cannot exclude liability for. Criminal liability, statutory liability, where the misrepresentation clause has been misrepresented and where there has been any other separate undertaking. For example, we refer to this as an oral warranty, or even separate conduct, which would actually constitute a form of estoppel, but where there's been a separate oral warranty which contradicts the terms of the exclusion clause, we can't exclude liability for that. There are then two statutory sets of provisions which we also have to consider. There was protection provided for consumers under the Unfair Terms and Consumer Contract Regulations 1999. Those were revised and updated, and then they're now restated in the Consumer Rights Act 2015. Those do not apply in the large transactions that we're looking at because no one is dealing as a consumer. We do still have to consider the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which imports a reasonableness test where we are excluding liability. So in all other cases where we're attempting to exclude liability, we still have to think and justify that this is reasonable in the circumstances. The point I made before is that in the markets that we're looking at, because we're dealing with either government agencies or large corporate borrowers or even smaller medium-sized borrowers, although they would still be considered to constitute possibly expert or sophisticated investors or borrowers because of the status and the amounts of funds that they are drawing down in these markets. If you are participating in these large international finance markets, you are clearly an organization of some status, sophistication, and understanding of market operation. The effect of that then means that the reasonableness test and the terms of application of the reasonableness test will be adjusted so that the relationship between the parties becomes much more equal and any duties of care become much less, because both sets of parties are aware of what they're dealing with and of the potential heads of loss and liability that could otherwise arise. I've then summarised in the text here some of the core provisions that would apply under the Unfair Contract Terms Act. So we're thinking about application more generally. We're looking at the specific terms of definition, any other guideline provisions, and any other specific points of application. We will see that negligence is defined as the breach of any obligation arising from the express and implied terms of the contract, to take reasonable care or exercise reasonable skill in the performance of the contract, or any common law duty to take reasonable care or exercise reasonable skill. The term must be fair and reasonable, having regard to the circumstances which were or ought reasonably to have been known or in contemplation of the parties at the time the contract was made. So with the reasonableness test, and we're applying that in terms of application, that's section 11.1. So it has to be reasonable in at the time that the contract was entered into, and reasonable is defined in terms of fair and reasonableness. There's additional guidelines in Schedule 2, which have regard to the strength of the bargaining position of the parties relative to each other, whether the customer received any inducement, whether the customer knew or ought reasonably to have known of the existence and extent of the term, including as a matter of trade custom, and whether it was reasonable at the time of the contract to expect that compliance would be practicable or possible. There's then some additional provisions with regards to the use of standard contract terms. This applies the reasonableness test where there's breach and the performance would be substantially different, or there's no performance at all. You then apply the reasonableness test in such cases. And we will exclude indemnity clauses by consumers in section 4.1. Misrepresentation is specifically subject to the misreasonableness test. The reasonableness test is applied to misrepresentation under section 3 of the Misrepresentation Act 1967. I've outlined all of the key provisions on this in the text and in the footnote. In practice, however, because we are dealing with these large companies and borrowers dealing with each other essentially on a professional basis, it becomes difficult to trigger the reasonableness test and to breach the reasonableness test, while many of the other clauses that we'll be looking at specifically in terms of no duty, exclusion and indemnity have been upheld by the courts on many occasions. You'll see here, I've referred to a number of the key decisions. One of the most important recent cases was the JP Morgan versus Springwell case. The judge had basically ruled against the borrower trying to claim for any, the investor in that case, trying to claim for any form of recovery, having suffered $500 million of loss on Russian government GKO linked notes, which had been sold by JP Morgan Chase through one of its salesmen, Justin Aitkinson, to a Greek shipping family. The Springwell family. And in that case, what had happened was it was Adam Polemis, the Polemis family, who had a portfolio of investments, and they had agreed to purchase these notes, including 500 million GKO notes, that were attractive because they were paying very generously. The question was, were they too high risk? Had JP Morgan Chase been under a duty to advise on the risk to ensure that the portfolio was kept in a balanced position that would not go against the interests of the customer? And specifically, because these were high risk and the Russian government did default on payment in ruble, which effectively prevented payments under the GKO notes. So the GKO notes became subject to, I think it was a material adverse change clause, so there was no payment possible, so they were effectively cancelled. The question was there any liability? In practice, as we would always expect, JP Morgan Chase had included a large number of basis clauses, disclaimers, indemnities, no duty type provisions. All of the possible protections that we could imagine had been incorporated, not in one, but in a number of separate documents. And the judge, Mrs. Justice Gloucester, basically held completely in favour of JP Morgan. The one concession was that Springwell was considered not to be a full execution-only client, but there was a very low, small, minimum duty of care owed. And you'll see that at the beginning of the second paragraph here. In that case then, what effectively happened was that there was no supervisory relationship. The judge considered that the disclaimers and limitation provisions were not exclusion clauses, but limited duty clauses, so therefore they weren't even subject to the reasonableness test. All of the relevant risks had been highlighted. The fact that Adam Polemis had ignored documents, and in particular had refused to sign, well, he was signing documents but refusing to read them, and he would actually say that to JP Morgan Chase: I am not reading this, I am not accepting any risk or liability, although I will sign it. The judge considered that that was essentially irresponsible. If he was signing documents, he had a duty to take care, because he was essentially creating liability for his own company by not confirming all of the relevant risk that arose. All of the protections were set out in a number of documents, including the dealings in developing country securities, a global master repurchase agreement, a master forward agreement, and the judge essentially considered that all of the protections that would normally have been provided for under standard contractual documentation were fully enforceable in that case. So I explain all the grounds, all the heads of possible liability, and the principal terms of the judgment there. You will see that this was in 2007. There was 68 days in court, 48 days of evidence, 14 days on submission. There was 232 pages of written and opening submissions alone, 520 pages of closing submissions, over 2,310 pages of closing submissions on behalf of Chase, with 23 sets of lever arch trial bundles and 390 arch files in total. The Springwell decision was appealed, and the appeal court essentially upheld the judgment of Mrs. Justice Gloucester almost without qualification. There are also a number of other interesting decisions in this area, which I've also referred to in the text. So you'll see, in particular, in footnote 76, there are a series of other very interesting finance cases. For example, IFE versus Goldman Sachs, the PK decision, the Dermala decision. These all essentially uphold the same approach by the court, whereby we are going to give full proper contractual effect to the protections that we've been describing. The no duty clauses, the exclusion clauses, and the various other protections that are involved. I will give you some separate notes on the key decisions. Just by way of example, in the IFE versus Goldman Sachs case, IFE had purchased bonds and warrants worth 20 million euros from Goldman Sachs. In information had been set out in an information memorandum. However, Goldman Sachs then received two further reports which qualified the information set out in the information memorandum. It did not separately notify that to the company. The question was, when the transaction subsequently failed it, was Goldman Sachs liable? And the judge in that case held that because of all of the exclusion clauses, there was no duty to update the reports, there had been no misrepresentation, and there was no separate duty which could have created any form of negligence. So essentially, all of the possible claims of liability were rejected in the Goldman Sachs case. Very similar in PK. In PK, that was also involving the Russian GKO notes, which had been sold by ANZ in that case. The director, Mr. Piquet, had received a misdescription of the nature and rights attached to the GKO notes, but still approved the purchase of $250,000 of notes. However, the terms of the investment had been set out in further detail in the final terms and conditions, what they refer to as the FTCs. And essentially what the judge concluded was that to the extent that Mr. Piquet had been deceived or had misunderstood the situation, he had been deceived by his own false error and assumption. All of the relevant information had been provided, and again, there was a full set of appropriate exclusions and disclaimers, so there was no liability on the part of ANZ in that case. There was another case, the Abu Dhabi case versus Morgan Stanley, which involved the sale of, I think it was, instruments following the global financial crisis. It was bonds, the value of which had been determined by credit rating agencies, but completely overpriced. This was one of the key factors which had caused the global financial crisis, whereby credit rating agencies had mispriced the risk, the ratings that they would apply to a large number of different structured finance instruments, including particularly collateralized debt obligations, CDOs. And we'll come back and look at CDOs in further detail in the securitization and structured finance classes. In this case, it was an Australian decision, it was an Australian court. It actually upheld the possibility that there could be liability to the extent that the investor in that case had relied on the ratings insofar as other parts of the market had been relying on the ratings. But legally, that's completely incorrect. So there is some support that would provide protection against the banks in favour of investors where they have lost money, in particular where bonds have been overrated by credit rating agencies, although I personally think this is highly questionable and a highly suspect decision which would not be applied in a commercial court judgment in London. There's also, for example, the Dermala case, Bankers Trust International, that involved fraudulent misrepresentations in relation to credit swaps. In that case, again, the judge takes a very much pro-contract, pro-bank, and essentially upholds the effectiveness of all of the clauses that we have been looking at. There is some small, narrow qualification of some of this in some separate, very recent cases. For example, and I'll give you separate notes on this, in the first Tower Trustees decision, Leggett J was looking at estoppel and the application of the reasonableness test under the Unfair Contract Terms Act with regards to these exclusion clauses or basis clauses. And what Leggett J considered was that you could not use the basis clause to simply avoid the application of the reasonableness test. If the reasonableness test would otherwise have applied, the clause cannot be used to exclude the reasonableness. It can be given normal contractual effect, but not simply to ensure avoidance of a reasonableness determination under the Unfair Contract Terms Act. Again, however, there's other decisions around the same time. This was in 2018, which actually confirm the application of these basis clauses: Premium Credit Limited and Gold Life Foods, and then Motor Track. I will, with Interactive eSolutions as well. I will put a separate note on the system from the Encyclopedia of Banking, which outlines all of this. Essentially, what we then have is a series of devices, perfectly legal, proper, professional techniques, which are used to control and manage liability in practice. And all of these are generally almost exclusively upheld and recognized as being legal, proper and appropriate by the courts, with some qualification, which we've already mentioned. In terms of liability, more generally, if anything does go wrong, if there is a breach and any misconduct, the heads of liability we can summarise as I have done at the end here: suspension or withholding, a further advance, cancellation of the obligation to lend, acceleration of repayment, rescission and damages. We will see that at least three of those provisions have direct corresponding contractual drafting in the Loan Market Association terms, although these will apply in practice anyway. With all of this, we can understand how we manage party relationships and party liability in practice. We've reviewed all of the heads of liability. We've looked at means of limiting it through limited duty, limited liability clauses, and then limitations on limited liability clauses, and then the types of remedies which would otherwise be available. We have to understand how all of this applies in practice so that we can manage and protect the interests of our client in any large, complex financial transaction and situation that our clients wish to enter into.